So with a not guilty plea from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, suddenly the self-proclaimed 9/11 mastermind will be in front of a New York jury trying to put the USA on trial. Should we be worried about open court becoming the center ring of a circus?
No trouble. Trouble's part of a circus. They said Barnum was in trouble when he lost Tom Thumb. They said he was true when Jumbo died.
Does the U.S. judiciary need to worry about ranting Al-Qaeda defendants? If the political circus comes to town in Lower Manhattan, who will put on the greatest show? Fearing or embracing the circus? Justice in the center ring on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, November 24th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Miles O'Brien filling in for Celeste Headlee, who's at home getting ready for Thanksgiving. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, John. Great to be here. Best to Celeste. Hope she's feeling better and everything. And coming up this hour, the president's getting closer to a decision on Afghanistan, and we get the latest. Does being in politics mean hanging out with the paparazzi instead of the politicos? Maybe more so these days. We talk about the celebrity strategy of Sarah Palin and Mike Huckabee, and maybe a little Lou Dobbs in there, too. And how much is too much when it comes to sharing in the workplace? We talk TMI in the office.
But first, Ron Kuby joins us, criminal defense attorney, civil rights lawyer. In your experience, Ron, and talking about that circus reference in court at the top of the hour, do defendants like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed get some sort of political upper hand under the rules in open federal criminal court?
They certainly do, especially in a place like New York City, which is the media capital of the world. The federal courtroom provides a fantastic forum for anybody who wishes to speak out to put forth their political agenda.
So this could be very different than the Massawi trial in Virginia.
Very much so. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed seems to be a lot more tightly wrapped than Mr. Massawi was, and he seems to actually have a coherent strategy.
And a lot more, perhaps, to say in open court. Stay with us, Ron Kuby. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning. Miles?
Checking the headlines for you. President Obama will reportedly announce his new strategy for Afghanistan during a primetime address a week from tonight. That's according to Politico.com. The president met with his national security team last night for the 10th time to discuss the strategy. It's the largest crib recall in U.S. history, more than 2 million drop-side cribs by Stork Craft Manufacturing being recalled because of a suffocation hazard due to babies becoming trapped. Scott Wolfson is with the Consumer Product Safety Commission. He says parents should stop using the cribs immediately.
4 babies have died in these cribs. It is urgent that parents hear about this crib and react to it right away.
Wolfson says if you have a Stork Craft crib, you should call the manufacturer right away.
Federal prosecutors have charged 8 men with recruiting U.S. immigrants to fight with an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group. 5 of the people recruited by the accused have been killed in fighting in Somalia, including at least one believed to have carried out the first suicide bombing by an American. Ralph Bolter is the FBI special agent in charge.
As these documents reflect, the subjects charged have collectively provided financial support to those who have traveled to fight on behalf of Al-Shabaab.
We'll have more on that story in just a moment. And first-time homebuyers deserve a pat on the back for yesterday's Wall Street rally. Home sales are nearly 37% higher last month than their bottom in January. Analysts say buyers took advantage of a tax credit, low mortgage rates, and falling prices. And stocks went to the stratosphere. The Dow climbed 133 points to 10,451. That's a 13-month high. The S&P is up 15 to 1,160. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,176. So, Miles, it's great to have you here today.
It's good to be here, John.
And, you know, we're going to talk. The question for our audience this morning is about a small provision of the Health Care Reform Act. It's called the CLASS Act, which would give up to $75 a day to people who care for their elderly relatives or chronically ill relatives, family members.
These are real-life dilemmas for people. What do you do in for long-term care for a grandmother or grandfather who needs it, and can you keep them in the home? How can that all be reconciled with this big bill?
And until now, you've been on your own. Does the federal government have a responsibility here? What's the issue in your household on long-term care? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. These are difficult conversations. What's it like in your house?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Kind of a big idea we're going to tackle here at the outset from two very different angles this morning. We're going to examine whether terrorist groups have something of an advantage here in a nation of democratic institutions. It's an old debate, and I think, Miles, it's fair to say that we've been considering whether American constitutional freedoms are an opening for groups like al-Qaeda since 9/11 and even before.
Yeah, are we willing to take those lumps to prove we have a system that is something that should be a model for the world?
Well, it's going to be tested. Do American constitutional rights increase the reach of groups like al-Qaeda in, say, recruiting and in delivering terrorist messages? Two intriguing and very different stories pose the same question this morning. Self-proclaimed 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, as we mentioned at the top of the hour, intends to plead not guilty at his terrorism trial, and that may provide him a podium to espouse al-Qaeda's views from a New York courtroom. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, federal officials, as we mentioned in the newscast, yesterday unsealed terror-related charges against eight men who were accused of recruiting Somali Americans from Minnesota to join an Islamic extremist group back in Somalia called Al-Shabaab. Officials say it's the largest arrest of American citizens alleged to be connected with an al-Qaeda affiliate. Abdi Ainte is an editor with Voice of America in Washington, D.C., has long experience covering the Somali community in Minneapolis and in Minnesota. Abdi Ainte, good morning.
Good morning to you, John.
First of all, how disruptive, how upset is the Somali community likely to be about the revelation of these indictments, these arrests, and how long has this been going on?
Well, I don't think the community will be disruptive in that sense. I think this case has been going on, or the investigation has been going on for at least a year or so in Minneapolis, and the community has been aware of it. In fact, the community has been impacted largely by the investigation for a year or so. And it has been going on since at least December of 2007, when young men of Somali descent, mostly American citizens who actually grew up in the Twin Cities,
right,
have begun to go back to Somalia to join this group, Al-Shabaab, that is now the main rebel group in Somalia against the internationally supported transitional federal government.
And what did we specifically learn yesterday, and principally how easy was it for the al-Shabaab recruiters, allegedly, to actually find adherents and sympathizers in the community in the Twin Cities?
Depends on how you look at it. If you think about the number of people that have so far been either recruited or accused of being part of this plot, the number is still very negligible. About 20 or so people are believed to have gone to Somalia or returned, and about a total of 14 people have been accused of either financing or recruiting or actually going to Somalia and joining this group. Yesterday's indictment was against eight people who are, some of them are not even in the United States. Some of them are actually in Somalia fighting alongside al-Shabaab already. So, you know, it has been, you can say that it has been somewhat easier for al-Shabaab to penetrate the Somali community in the Twin Cities and recruit about two dozen people. But on the other hand, when you look at the a very large number of the Somali community, estimated between 40 to 60,000,
sure,
the number is still negligible.
Abdi Ainte helped to report this story for the New York Times as a former reporter with experience looking into the Somali community there in Minnesota. Ram Kubi, criminal defense attorney and civil rights lawyer here in the studio. What is the sense in which cases like this raise the specter that entire communities are going to be targeted by investigators and that some sort of net will be thrown around communities like the Somali community in the Twin Cities? There are Afghan communities in Virginia. There are all sorts of communities all over the United States.
Whenever something like this happens, the local community is concerned that they'll be targeted. But this particular set of arrests and this particular indictment seems very narrowly drawn to basically go after the people who are responding to this Facebook jihad, as it were, as well as to go after the people who are specifically recruiting them to basically participate in a teenage Islamic youth scene, sort of Lord of the Flies with automatic weapons in Somalia.
Well, which is pretty terrifying, and it seems like easy pickings.
Well, it is frightening in Somalia, But remember, the political situation in Somalia is incredibly complex, and it doesn't necessarily translate to terrorism here.
Well, let's turn our attention to the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed revelation that we got over the weekend, that he's going to plead not guilty along with his defendants in the criminal court, and that raises the possibility that the KSM trial will be something of a circus, as we mentioned at the top. The only experience we have with this is the Zacharias Moussaoui trial. Here's Ed McMahon, an attorney in Washington, D.C., who is the court-appointed attorney for Zacharias Moussaoui. And this was his reaction to a comparison between what happened at that trial and what might happen in the KSM trial.
He testified and he said many awful things. He was boasted about the attacks of 9/11. He in many ways laughed at the loss that the people that had testified in the courtroom had suffered. I think, if I remember correctly, he testified why he thought the attacks were justified. And when he was done and the verdict was rendered, he's now spending the rest of his life in a prison.
Now, Edward McMahon seems to suggest that no matter how circus-like the trial gets, it's the verdict that is all that really counts here.
Well, the fascinating thing about this case is there's a tremendous unity of purpose between Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the government. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed isn't trying to beat the rap. In fact, the rap is probably unbeatable. He wants the government to execute him. And our government wants to execute him. Now, what could possibly go wrong with that?
By pleading not guilty?
Sure.
He still wants to be executed?
Sure, because it goes like this. He is in a position to represent himself. He won't be a regular defendant who is seen but not heard except when he testifies. If he chooses to represent himself, which he can, then he has tremendous access to every single part of the proceeding. And in every part of the proceeding, he'll be able to articulate in one way or another his views, whatever they happen to be at the time.
Evidence questions complicated the Zacharias Moussaoui case. They're likely to be more complicated in this case. If the prosecutors are not allowed to use torture evidence in the case, then they will have to maybe bring in classified sources and methods that gave them some indication that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was who he said he was.
No, I don't think
not
that that's
happen.
The case. Look. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed indeed confessed after coercive techniques, torture. The government can't use and won't try to use those confessions. But he also made a perfectly fine, admissible confession in open court down at the military tribunal where he announced that he did it. I did it. I want to plead guilty. Kill me. That was basically his position. And that will be admissible against him.
So the circus is actually a help in terms of noting the strength of our constitutional protection. If the trial is a circus-like trial, it doesn't necessarily mean justice can't be done.
Not a bad thing at all, especially since these guys don't look nearly as scary once they're in a courtroom. Moussaoui was terrifying at the time, not so scary anymore.
And it's more than 8 years later. Ron Kuby, criminal defense attorney and civil rights lawyer with experience in terrorism cases right here in the studio, and Abdi Ainte, editor with the Voice of America in Washington, who has lots of experience reporting on that Somalia community in Minnesota. Thanks for those two looks at a complex story. And now, a little after 15 minutes past the hour, let's take a look at some of the top stories we're following.
Eight more people have been charged with terrorist-related activities in Minnesota. Some of the men are alleged to have been recruited from mosques in Minneapolis to fight with the militant group Al-Shabaab in Somalia. The group has been designated a foreign terrorist organization by the State Department. Ralph Bolter, the special agent in charge, says evidence links the defendants to the militant group.
As these documents reflect, the subjects charged have collectively provided financial support to those who have traveled to fight on behalf of Al-Shabaab.
The U.S. District Court in Minneapolis is investigating a total of 14 people. President Barack Obama's plans for the war in Afghanistan will come within days. That's the word from White House spokesman Robert Gibbs. Gibbs says the president, and we quote him now, has the information he wants and needs to make his decision.
Politico.com is reporting that address will take place in primetime next Tuesday. It's the largest recall of baby cribs in U.S. history. Consumer Product Safety Commission says more than 2 million drop-side cribs made by Stork Craft Manufacturing are being recalled because of a suffocation danger. Coming up, what's the cost of love nowadays? For Mark Sanford, it's 37 counts of ethics violations. We talk more about what the South Carolina governor faces after he traveled to Argentina in June to meet his mistress.
Hey, you want that to go?
Good morning, everyone. So, you ever order takeout, Miles O'Brien?
Yeah.
Yeah, we got some takeouts
on
New
York. Of course, order takeout.
Todd Zwillick, you want to meet him? He's our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, meet Miles. Miles, meet Todd.
Hey, Todd. I've met Miles before.
Yeah, how are you?
Hey, Miles.
Todd has some breaking news, I believe.
Yeah, John, of course, the president had his ninth war council last night on the war effort in Afghanistan and, to an increasing extent, Pakistan. We're hearing reports this morning now that that announcement from the president on potential increased troop levels and on a strategy in Afghanistan is supposed to come on Tuesday. So a week from today, nobody really expected that announcement to come while the Indian prime minister was in town, as he is today, and certainly not before Thanksgiving. So we're looking at Tuesday.
Well, there are issues to discuss with the Indian prime minister because this is a regional issue. It's not simply about Afghanistan. But any indication how this announcement will be made? It's probably not going to be a line, sort of tossed onto some sort of computer printout somewhere, right?
No, the White House officials have already said that they want the president to be able to make this clear to the American public, since there's been so much attention, so much anticipation, charges, of course, of dithering from the Republican side and former Vice President Dick Cheney. So they're already reportedly working on a major speech. I don't know the venue or the format, but I think we can see the president make one of his sort of hallmark, perhaps primetime speeches to try to get the public on board with where he wants to go with Afghanistan. And he has to get Congress on board as well.
And very quickly, he's got a list of face-to-faces he has to complete before he can make any announcement, right? Who are the big names?
Defense Secretary Gates is coming up today, but Speaker of the House is coming up today as well. You have to think that Afghanistan is going to be on the agenda, and there's a reason for it. There are a growing number of powerful congressmen on the left, notably the Appropriations Chairman, David Obey, who say they don't want to fund this war, and if they're going to be asked to fund the war, they've gone as far as to say we should have a war surtax, so that people know the cost. That's not going to pass, but there's a lot of angst about how to fund this war, whether to have a troop increase.
Regional issue and a congressional political issue. Todd Zwillich, thanks so much. So moving now to Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. Louise, Miles O'Brien. Miles,
hi there.
Meet Louise.
Good to see you, Louise.
Miles, have you ever had a balloon payment you had to deal with in the mortgage or something?
Yeah, and it gets your attention, doesn't it?
Well, the federal government apparently has something like a balloon payment coming up in its more than $12 trillion aggregate debt. Explain.
Should we pony up here? Should we all chip in?
Well, you're going to have to.
Yeah.
So if the debt stays like it is, you know, we added $2 trillion of debt in the last year. And what we're looking at is by 2019 having $700 billion in interest payments just on this debt. So that's $500 billion more than we're paying per year in interest right now. And to put that $500 billion figure into context for you, that is higher than the entire budget for the Education Department, the Energy Department, Homeland Security, and for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And these will be yearly payments that we have to make. And I'm just looking at the New York Times sort of calculation.
Not to reduce the debt.
Right.
Just to pay the interest on the debt.
That's like, you just keep it's the minimum payment. It's the minimum credit card payment.
It's the interest only, like on your mortgage.
Right.
And are there any late fees if we don't pay on time?
There would certainly be problems.
Well, it would rock the entire financial system, right?
It would rock the financial system because, you know, the U.S. government debt is supposed to be the safest. That's why in the last year we've actually seen our interest cost go down. We were paying less than a percentage point on average for our debt because investors, when they were worried during the financial crisis, came into treasuries, came into the dollar. The problem is now that we're getting a bit of a recovery, they're going into other assets, and we won't benefit necessarily from such low interest rates on our debt in the future.
So interest rates will balloon, and that's why the yearly interest maintenance payment has gone from $200 billion to $500 billion, and you say by 2019
it'll be $700 billion, $500 billion more than where
Louise
we are.
Louise Story, thanks so much. Scary.
Nice gift for our kids, isn't it?
And our final takeout comes from the mighty Quinn. Mark Quinn, host of The Big Picture on SCE Television in Columbia, South Carolina, where it looks like your governor, Mark Quinn, is going to finally face the music. Mark Sanford, what's the story?
Well, you know, he's got 37 ethics counts against him. That's the most that any governor's faced in more than a quarter century, John. Some of these, you know, range from very small in nature to pretty big. I think maybe the biggest one, he was on a trade mission down in South America, suddenly left, bought a first-class ticket to go to Argentina to take care of business in his mind, but I don't think it was state business, if you know what I mean.
Well, it was all involved with that mistress, and then it all became very, very public. I guess, you know, Miles and I were talking about this morning. Ethics violations?
Yeah, what about felonious stupidity? Is that a charge?
There's a lot of questions about that. The fact is, I don't know how much stomach there is at this point to say, hey, let's make a serious move to oust the governor. There's a lot of Republicans in charge who are extremely worried about elections next November, that if this stays in the news, that if this drags out until next February, May, or so, somewhere along those lines, and Sanford will draw it out, that it could just hurt the Republican Party tremendously. So I don't know how far this will go besides plenty of fines, lots of condemnations. He's already persona non grata with most people, so it's not as if this is the worst thing that's ever happened to him, if that
right.
makes any sense.
So nailing him for using state money to buy business class tickets or using state aircraft or using campaign funds for personal expenses is not necessarily going to force him to make a deal, right?
Probably not, but it certainly shed some light on what he used to portray himself as, the most frugal man in government, which really hasn't proved to be true. So.
Well, he's certainly high profile. He's got a certain kind of celebrity, Mark Quinn. We're going to talk about the very different kind of celebrity that Sarah Palin and Mike Huckabee have in just a moment. But, Mark, thanks so much for bringing us up to date there.
No, you bet, John. Always a pleasure, buddy.
Mark Quinn, host of The Big Picture on SCE Television, talking about 37 counts of ethics abuse that Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina is going to be facing. Coming up, what can Sarah Palin and Mike Huckabee learn from Paris Hilton? We talk about the political strategy by some to put the campaigning aside and become...
Good morning. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste. Coming up, is Sarah Palin a celebrity first and a politician second?
Yes.
I think
yes.
the answer might
yes.
I think that is
in
the
a word,
correct
yes.
answer. In a word, yes. We talk with New York Times columnist Ross Douthat in a few moments about that. Right now, let's check the top stories 30 minutes past the hour. We may hear President Obama's new strategy in Afghanistan as early as next week. Politico.com says the president is expected to address the nation in a primetime speech a week from tonight and lay that strategy out. It's the largest recall of baby cribs in U.S. history. More than 2 million drop-side cribs being recalled after reports of deaths of 4 infants. The Consumer Product Safety Commission is urging parents to stop using the Stork Craft manufacturing crib. Some of the cribs have Fisher-Price logos on it instead of Stork Craft, so beware there. In the past few minutes, NASA astronauts aboard the International Space Station gave a press conference about the work they've been doing up there the past week. Press conference live from the station. One journalist here on Earth asked the astronauts what was their most exciting moment so far.
Most exciting moment. I think last night when we had dinner over at Node 1, we all kind of sat down and, you know, Frank pulled out some Belgian food and we had all different kinds of Russian food and we all sat down and kind of reflected on the mission.
Yeah, some multinational crew up there, and they ate appropriately. A dozen of them up there in all. Atlantis heads back to Earth or begins a journey back to Earth tomorrow. 7 people aboard Atlantis.
Try this on for size. Lou Dobbs, President Dobbs. Do you ever call him that over at CNN, Miles?
Always. Mr. President.
He's considering a run for the White House in 2012. And get this, Sarah Palin's book has sold 700,000 copies in the first week of release. More about that coming right up. Those are some of the stories we're watching.
Hi, it's Miles O'Brien, and here's a presidential ticket to ponder this morning, as John was just discussing. Think of this one, Dobbs-Palin, or is it Palin-Dobbs?
I think Palin-Dobbs.
Palin-Dobbs, probably. Former CNN anchor Lou Dobbs is now hinting in his ever-so-subtle way that he's thinking about a run for the Oval Office. Meanwhile, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee is playing pundit on Fox News. So we wonder this morning if the culture of celebrity has completely overtaken politics. Have Sarah Palin and Huckabee chosen to forego politics in order to focus on their celebrity status? That's the view of our next guest, New York Times columnist Ross Douthat. And we're also joined this morning by our friend Cindy Gallup. Cindy's an advertising consultant and former chairman of the advertising agency BBH. Good morning to you. Good to have you with us.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you write that Huckabee and Palin have sort of decided to go for the limelight instead of doing the hard work of governing, and that might hurt them ultimately. Why?
Well, I think it probably hurts Palin a little bit more than Huckabee because Huckabee at least has two long terms as governor of Arkansas behind him. But if you look at both of them, you know, they were two candidates who nobody had heard of before the 2008 presidential election. They were candidates in a party, the Republican Party, that wasn't exactly overrun with highly appealing candidates. And they became, you know, rock stars. In Sarah Palin's case, a very polarizing rock star. But they became candidates who people really, really liked. But they were also candidates who seemed like, you know, I mean, if you look at the polling numbers, people you know, even the people who liked Sarah Palin often said they thought she wasn't qualified to be president. And so,
all right, but being a rock star,
both of them had work to do making themselves more credible, and but, I don't think they've really done that work.
Ross, but being a rock star actually works. President Obama used celebrity very much so on his road to the White House, right?
He did use celebrity, although I tend to think that actually Obama's celebrity hurts him politically as much as it helps him. It helps him an awful lot in, especially among Democrats and liberals. It helped him enormously in the primary campaign against Hillary Clinton. But if you look back at the worst moment of Barack Obama's presidential campaign, it was arguably when he went over to Europe in the middle of the summer and had, you know, millions of Germans thronging Berlin to cheer him on and so on. And the McCain campaign was able to run a bunch of pretty effective campaign ads making fun of him for being a celebrity.
Although he was, although Russ, he was pretty established at that point as having won primaries and having had electoral victories. Cindy Gallup, how do we assess whether political celebrity is actually the seed of a political brand?
Well, to some extent, I think the definition may be a bit artificial, because if you are a politician, you are a celebrity by definition, especially in a world where people like Spencer Pratt and Heidi Montag can be classified as celebrities. These days,
right.
A very wide range of people can also be called celebrities in addition to whatever they do. So I find it slightly artificial.
So people don't care so much about the resume anymore?
Well, no, I think people do care. But to be frank, when you look at somebody like Sarah Palin, when the father of your child has just taken it all off, your daughter's child has just taken it all off for Playboy and his mother is headed for jail, I think you have to find a whole new definition of credibility to live up to. And to some extent, she's got nothing to lose by putting it all out there and encouraging people to see the picture that she wants them to see in an arena where she can perhaps define and manage it more.
But in the Obama case, Ross, you know, the next step for Obama after he announced his book and went on his tour and sort of did the celebrity thing very early in 2006 was he got connected with big Democratic pockets, big money. There's no evidence that Sarah Palin is at that stage, right?
Well, that's definitely true. But it's also true if you look at the book that Obama wrote. The Audacity of Hope is, I mean, Obama had the advantage of already having written his memoir and with Dreams from My Father, but The Audacity of Hope is basically a long policy book. It's a book that, you know, lays the groundwork for a serious substantive presidential run. Now, there's still time for Sarah Palin to write that kind of book, but I think the difference between his book and her book is telling, and it gets to the issue about what Obama was able to do. He was able to be a celebrity who always had one foot in policy wonkery, substance, and so on. And that's a two-step maybe Palin will be able to manage, but it doesn't. She isn't doing it at the moment.
So, Cindy, celebrity in and of itself is not enough to fuel a campaign?
No, it absolutely isn't, but it can be leveraged. And the benefits that celebrity brings of being able to put your story out there and expose areas of yourself and your views that you would like to get to a wider audience can potentially be, I think, advantageous.
You're describing it as a kind of camouflage. It's sort of you can stay in the celebrity game and you're not nobody.
Funny enough, I would say it's the direct opposite of camouflage. In the old world order, politicians were encouraged to keep their personal lives and personal facts behind closed doors. In the New World Order, there is no such thing as closed doors. You've got a huge amount of people using every tool on the internet at their disposal to find out everything about you. Why not actually preempt that by putting it all out there yourself so that you can at least take charge to some extent of some of that dialogue and have people see what you want them to see? They're going to see it anyway.
So Ross, it's about controlling the message, and you use the celebrity to do that.
In part, yes, although it's very easy to have that run away from you, I think. I mean, if you look at, you know, if you take a case like John Edwards, right, over the past year or so, I'd say John Edwards' celebrity quotient has gone way up compared to where he was a year ago. I mean, he's been featured in many, many more gossip magazines, for instance, than he ever was while he was running for president as a kind of earnest, policy-obsessed wonk. But obviously that hasn't been a good thing for John Edwards' political career, because he's been featured in gossip magazines for cheating on his cancer-stricken wife. So, I mean, I think the content of the celebrity really, really matters. It's not enough to just say that,
you know, you can put it all out there and use it to your advantage.
All right.
There are still things that can't be used to your advantage.
Ross Douthat, thank you very much. Cindy Gallup, thanks for coming in. We appreciate the... Well, I wish you could see the pants. I wish you could see Cindy's pants. I wish you could. They're unbelievable. That's all I can say.
Coming up, we talk about your work life every Tuesday. And today, when the water cooler talk gets way too personal. TMI in the workplace. More on that later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Miles O'Brien. President Barack Obama hosts the first White House state dinner of his term tonight. Did you get invited?
No, you know, I couldn't make it anyway.
Yeah,
but,
lost in the mail. The guest of honor is the Indian Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh. He and the president and 320 other guests, not us, will dine in a large tent on the White House South Lawn. I guess it's too big for the state dinner room.
I think it'll be impressive either way.
Yeah. Nia Malika Henderson is with us this morning. She's White House reporter for Politico.com. She's been covering the state dinner. And Nia, good morning to you. Good to have you with us.
Good morning. Good to be here.
All right. So what's on the menu tonight?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, there have been more leaks about the Afghanistan war than there have been about this state dinner.
This is a tightly held need-to-know thing, huh?
What's that?
Tightly held and on a need-to-know basis, huh?
Exactly, exactly. There'll be an unveiling this afternoon at about 2 p.m. The First Lady's going to host an unveiling of the menu, of the china that she's going to use, and the flower patterns. So we'll find out then. We do know that it likely won't be Indian. I talked to some past ushers, and it's pretty much considered bad policy to serve the dish of the country that's being honored.
Yeah.
So they'll probably have kind of hints of Indian food throughout the meal. They're also going to likely use herbs from the White House garden and some honey from the beehives that are on the South Lawn there.
Oh, good,
so
good.
That's what we know so far.
So reduces the carbon footprint. We like that. But so American food. Darn it, we're having American food here, right?
Exactly.
Because, you know, I mean, really, it would be bad form to serve up chicken curry and it just doesn't taste right, right? That would be bad.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, now we hear Steven Spielberg will be there, Jeffrey Katzenberg, some Hollywood luminaries there, and, of course, Oprah may be there as well. What else do we know about the list?
Well, again, this is, you know, a tightly held secret. The list is going to come out today. Again, there are about 320 people on the list. One of the things we do know, we're hearing that the entertainment tonight is going to be Jennifer Hudson, who, of course, has the Chicago connection with the Obamas and performed at the DNC in August of 2008. So we're hearing that she is going to entertain this black tight crowd tonight. So we do know that. And, yeah, the list, of course, the usual suspects will be there, Secretary of State Clinton. Bill Clinton will not be there. Apparently he had some other engagements. He of course had about 30 of his own state dinners, but it's not really a case of been there, done that for him. We heard that he just had a prior engagement.
Okay. Well, are you buying that one? I don't know. We can leave that aside. We'll leave that one aside. Now, why are they doing it in a tent and not inside the White House?
Well, it's because they want to have a bigger event. The state dining room only fits about 150 people. George Bush, for his dinner in 2005, for Prime Minister Singh, he hosted about 130 people, and that was in the state dining room.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton, of course, when he had his dinner for Prime Minister Singh in I think it was 2000, he had a tent outside, and it was about 700 people were there. So the tent just allows for more folks to be there.
Quick final thought, Nia. Is it bad form to bring up geopolitical issues at these dinners? I mean, will there be a side order of Kashmir and Afghanistan tonight? I mean,
right.
Or you just stay away from that and just do the toasts and leave it there?
Toast pretty much, and all of that will happen in the bilateral meetings that will happen earlier today. So believe me, they will be talking Afghanistan and Pakistan, the economy, China, climate. So they'll have really meaty discussions before this is all happens tonight.
Meaty discussions and a meaty meal. Nia Malika Henderson, White House reporter for thePolitico.com. Thanks.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It takes John Huckenberry and Miles O'Brien to sit in for Celeste Headlee, who's home hopefully feeling better.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
We talk about your work life every Tuesday, and when sharing goes overboard in the workplace, we're going to have a discussion of too much information on the job in just a few minutes. But first, let's check in to the headlines at just about 48 minutes past the hour. The White House has been talking about the president's Afghanistan policy. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says the key to President Barack Obama's revised Afghanistan policy is, quote, not just how we get people there, but what's the strategy for getting them out. Gibbs' comments come as President Obama met with his Afghan war council yesterday for the ninth time.
It's the largest crib safety recall in U.S. history. More than 2 million drop-side cribs by Storkcraft Manufacturing of Canada being recalled after reports of 4 infant suffocations. Check your cribs this morning, parents. This is something. A Belgian man who doctors thought was in a coma for 23 years. Turns out he was conscious all along. Ram Hooben was severely brain damaged after a car crash in 1993 and was paralyzed. It wasn't until a doctor looked at his brain patterns that he discovered he could hear, see, and understand everything around him. Mr. Hooben's story came to light after he was written about in a medical paper.
He just couldn't communicate. It wasn't like he was cheating or something. He wasn't hiding.
It's hard to imagine what that was like to be locked inside that way.
Well, we've been reporting all morning that 8 Americans of Somali descent traveled from the Minneapolis area to Somalia between September 2007 and October of 2009 to train with Al-Shabaab. It's a terrorist organization with links to Al-Qaeda. And we've gotten a reaction to arrests this morning in that case and what it means for terrorist investigations here in the United States. But we wanted to take a look at who are Al-Shabaab? Why are they targeting America? Well, how close is their affiliation with Al-Qaeda in Somalia? To help us answer that, we're joined by our friend, BBC Africa editor Martin Plaut, who joins us from London. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
So we've had arrests. Now 14 people are in custody. Apparently 20 or more people were recruited into Al-Shabaab. Who are Al-Shabaab and what sort of a threat do they represent either to the United States or to people in Somalia?
Well, I'm not sure they represent any real threat to the United States, except in as much as they recruit kids from Minneapolis, places like that. But they certainly are a threat to the government of Somalia, which is fighting desperately to try and hang on to power. All they really control is a couple of streets in Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia. These people were originally sent over by supporters to go and fight the Ethiopians who invaded Somalia, took over Somalia to try and kick out people like Al-Shabaab. How close are the links with Al-Qaeda? Well, that's far from clear, to be honest. Although Al-Shabaab has said that they are loyal to Al-Qaeda, I'm not really sure that there are very strong links, although it has been alleged for some time that there are.
Now, on our program, someone who has observed this case in the United States suggested that this is kind of like a Facebook youth adventure plan for people who want to get involved in terrorism. Is it more dangerous than that from where you sit?
Well, it certainly is for the people involved, and they're not all Somalis. There are some people who are of sort of a white background, shall we say. And, you know, the other thing to remember is that from their point of view, they're all good Muslims doing their duty by Islam. There is no such thing as a nation under Islam. Everybody should go and help their comrades. And in a sense that you could almost see them like Che Guevara going off to fight in Bolivia or in Congo.
Indeed, and you make a great point. Martin Plaut, they were recruited allegedly from mosques in the United States in the Twin Cities area. BBC Africa editor Martin Plaut, thanks so much. So at the risk of saying button your lip, today's Tuesday, our workday discussion involves the volatile mixture of office banter, loose tongues, and personal information. Sure, you get close to your workmates, but does anyone need to know details like this?
I feel so stupid. I gotta tell someone. Promise not to tell.
I promise.
I have on Bill's underwear.
Charlie.
I know. I'm so ashamed. I can't believe I'm sitting here in light blue jockey shorts.
Of course, some of the office banter from the TV sitcom Designing Women. So how much is too much information, or TMI? When can running your mouth at work get you into trouble? And personal information, of course, circulates. Here with the answer is Beth Kobliner, takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. And Rhonda Tate. Rhonda's a labor and employment lawyer who's seen firsthand the legal issues of too much information in the workplace. She joins us on the line from Detroit. Rhonda, is this a serious legal issue, or is it the stuff of sitcoms?
Good morning, John. Thank you for having me
here
today.
It can be a legal issue at times, and oftentimes the sitcoms do present situations that have very well popped up in the court systems. The problem that can arise when people give too much information in the workplace is that what you say can come back to haunt you and even be used against you. Oftentimes, employees will become involved in some sort of employment dispute with their employer, and sometimes information that they've provided to their fellow employees can come back in the form of witness statements if the proceedings in the court system in terms of discovery allow for that, or even in administrative agency proceedings. So sometimes what you say can come back to bite you.
So, Rhonda Tate, there's the sort of cautionary tale. But Beth Koebleiner, I mean, nobody likes that person in the office who doesn't say anything, and you don't even know if they're married or not. You have no idea if they've ever...
It's hard, you know, because you're like a family. I feel like a family here, you know. You want to come in and talk about what's going on. And what happens is you divulge information that you're not really even thinking about, and then your boss has all this information about you, which you may or may not want him to ultimately have. For example, you know, I came a little late today, and I ran in and I said, oh, my gosh, you know, my 5-year-old was up in the middle of the night, and my husband's out of town. And then I realized I was talking to, you know, Mark, the executive producer, and like maybe I didn't need to share all that. Maybe I could have just said,
never tell him.
Yeah, it was a lesson. And I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, there was an example of a woman who was out a lot from work, and her boss was annoyed. He thought she was job hunting, but it turned out she was taking care of her sick father.
Well, so how do you protect yourself? How do you protect yourself?
You absolutely only want to share something that has to do with your job. If it's something that, if it's a physical illness or something you'll need an accommodation for, which is a legal issue, then you have to tell your job. If you're pregnant, actually, it can work in your favor to tell your boss as soon as you know, because then they can't generally fire you. It's much more difficult. That's a sort of a cynical view of it. Hmm. But more and more, you know, that is the case, that your employer gets into a tricky position. But when it comes to, I went out late and I partied, or I don't do this, but people do, I hear. And, you know, whatever it is that people do.
No upside to this, right?
No upside. Only positive news.
But if you divulge too little, do you hurt yourself? You know, I mean, because you want to have a personality as well,
exactly.
Right?
Hold on with that. But Rhonda, you know? are there issues where non-disclosure can get you in legal trouble? And then we'll get Beth's take on that.
Well, non-disclosure oftentimes does not get you into legal trouble unless it's a situation such as Beth just raised, which is a good situation, information that's relating to perhaps your medical state. I know of a particular case that happened here in Detroit where a City of Detroit police officer was pregnant, and that was an example just raised by Beth, and the City of Detroit Police Department did have rules that required pregnant employees, once they reached a point where they could no longer perform their job duties, to then take a leave of absence. And so you do have to comply with the rules that your employer does have set in place. So it's very important that employees are aware of the rules and policies that are in place, and to review their policy manuals, the employee policy manuals that are issued at the time that they begin their employment, and make sure that they are complying with their job requirements.
So Beth, does this all mean that we're not really friends in the office, even though it seems
that way? I'm your friend, John, but other than me, I think the bottom line is nothing is private. You have to realize no matter what you tell your coworkers, you know, the takeaway is whether you tell your coworkers, your boss, it's going to get out there. You want to, you know, give them enough information that's positive. They want to know you're a great parent, you know, a great sister, whatever it is you are, but keep it positive and, you know, keep it on business.
Keep it on business. All interesting stuff to think about. Beth Koebleiner, takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. And Rhonda Tate, thanks so much. Labor and employment lawyer out there in Detroit. Rhonda and Beth, thanks so much. Miles, I'd really like to share.
Go ahead
with
share,
you. Yeah.
But not too much.
Yeah, I have a mole over here.
I don't want to know.
Sorry. If you have a story about work or when somebody shared too much, go ahead and share with us. Maybe you got burned. Maybe it was a bad consequence for you, like Beth and Rhonda were saying. Either tell us the information or, tell us what the consequence was. 877-8 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. It's a nasty. Yeah. You're kind of a science guy. You know about moles, right?
Yeah, I'd like to look at it closely.
Every family faces it. Every person faces it. Long-term care, elder care, nursing home care. You got another name for it?
Today is the first day of the rest of my life.
Call it what you will, the issue of long-term care insurance is one of the expensive, difficult-to-discuss sideshows in the healthcare reform debate. No, it's not too early to talk about long-term care. Hey, you 20-somethings may end up paying for all of it on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, Tuesday, November 24th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Miles O'Brien filling in for Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, John. Good to be here. Coming up this hour, forget Windows versus Mac, the latest media battle, Google versus Fox.
Wow.
Interesting. Our week-long series on faith continues as well. Today we talk about interfaith relationships. And we go to space, of course. NASA.
You live there, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Most of the time. A space cadet, proudly. Charlie Bolden will be with us, NASA administrator. And the question for him is how to engage kids on the subject of science and technology and engineering.
But first, we're joined by Ilza Erner, professor at Hunter College's School of Social Work. Ilza, good morning.
Good morning.
So your father is in a nursing home. You're taking care of your 90-year-old mother at home.
Yes.
And as tough as it is for families to talk about long-term care, do you think Congress is ready for a frank discussion of the costs and the issues in long-term care in families?
No. What I'd like to say to them, sit down, boys and girls. We have a conversation that needs to take place. It's not about health care and it's not about the economy. It's about caretaking. Who's going to do what, when, and how much it's going to cost?
Well, that's perfectly said. We're going to have that conversation. We come back in a moment. Ilza, stay with us. But first, everything else you need to know this morning. Miles?
Thank you, John. We may hear President Obama's new strategy in Afghanistan as early as next week. Politico.com says the president is expected to address the nation in prime time a week from tonight. This comes after the president held what appears to be a final, maybe the 10th, strategy session with his national security team last night. It is the largest crib recall in U.S. history, more than 2 million dropside cribs by Stork Craft Manufacturing being recalled after four infants suffocated to death. Parents, you should check those cribs out. Robert Sirigliano is the father of a baby who died in one of those dropside cribs.
The thing was, there was never any warnings about these cribs. And after research, we found that a lot of these cribs had caused injuries and deaths.
That's tragic. If you have a Stork Craft crib, you should call the manufacturer or go to its website. Federal prosecutors have charged 8 men with recruiting U.S. immigrants to fight with a militant group in Somalia. 5 of the people recruited by the accused have been killed in fighting already, including at least one believed to have carried out the first suicide bombing by an American.
Back to the White House. President Obama welcomes India's prime minister to the White House today. They'll try to resolve differences on climate change and U.S. ties with Indian rivals China and Pakistan. And there's an official state dinner tonight. After 3 spacewalks and delivering 15 tons of spare parts, the crew of the shuttle Atlantis will spend the day wrapping things up at the International Space Station. The Atlantis departs for Earth tomorrow. The Dow climbed 133 points to 10,451 yesterday. That's a 13-month high, and it comes as home sales were nearly 37% higher last month than their bottom in January. Analysts say buyers took advantage of a tax credit, which caused the rally. The Nasdaq begins at 2,176, and the S&P is up 15 to 1,106. As part of long-term care discussion, we are hearing how families deal with the issue of caretaking in their own house.
My name is Jan from Detroit. When my mother suffered a stroke, which added to her other health problems, she could accept nothing less than care in her own home. Fortunately, the 4 Detroit area siblings were in a position to provide 24-hour care with help from hospice and a part-time home health aide.
It's an issue in families all over America. 877-8-MY-TAKE with your story. We're going to talk about it in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Miles O'Brien and Ilza Lerner there. Did you hear her at the top? She said it perfectly.
She set the table perfectly for this discussion.
Boys and girls, we have to sit down and have a conversation. Have you had a conversation in your family about long-term care for your parents or grandparents?
Well, we dealt with it with my grandmother, and for her, being in her house was a big deal. And so it was at great financial cost, but it was worth it in the end. But these are discussions you have to have soon.
Well, the Congress is likely to begin those discussions. A little known but very important provision in the Health Care Reform Act that is currently on the floor of the Senate and will begin debate next week is called the Class Act, introduced by the late Ted Kennedy, to subsidize elder care. And Ilse Erner, professor at Hunter College's School of Social Work, she lives in upstate New York. Your mother moved in with you in 2007, right?
That's correct.
You also have three children, and your father is in a nursing home up there in Columbia County, New York, right?
That's correct.
Now, are you expecting any money from the federal government, any sort of cavalry assistance here in what you've been doing on your own up till now?
You know, I've been standing at the top of the hill looking for the cavalry. They're nowhere in sight. You know, I think one of the most important points about my experience was that my taking care of my parents was not planned. We did not have that conversation about what happens when. And so I think, you know, if you're looking at what the most significant point about that is that it often happens as a surprise, and it's a very expensive surprise.
A very expensive surprise. Well, Paula Spann is also with us. She's the author of When the Time Comes, Families with Aging Parents Share Their Struggles and Solutions. And she writes the New York Times blog, The New Old Age. Paula, thanks for being with us here in the studio.
Thank you.
And Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins us from D.C., who knows every provision of the Health Care Reform Act. Okay, so Ilse is on the top of the hill looking for the cavalry, Todd. Is she likely to hear anything in the debate that begins next week?
She's going to hear plenty on it. Congress is trying to address this, as you said, John. Now, what Congress wants to do, it's not about paying for people who are in nursing homes already. This is about trying to keep our parents and grandparents out of the nursing home to the extent that we can, just like Miles said he was trying to do in his family. The Class Act basically charges workers on a voluntary basis a payroll tax, you know, a payroll fee, something around premiums, maybe around $120 a month. What you get for that is that when it's time for home care or some kind of care to keep you out of the nursing home, you get maybe $75 a day to pay for that home care so that you can stay at home like Miles' family wanted to do. Of course, John, there's a problem with it. This Class Act is quickly becoming one of the long list of problems that the conservative and moderate Democrats have with this bill.
Before we talk about the politics, though, Todd, let's put it to Paula Spann. Is $75 a day, is a kind of a Social Security program for long-term care a token symbolic act, or does it represent a breakthrough that we're suddenly thinking about federal responsibility for elder care?
No, it's not a token. $50 or $75 a day would be it will not pay for everything, but it will pay for, let's say, about half of a monthly charge for assisted living. It would pay for several hours a day of home care. And the Class Act gives people a cash benefit so they can use it as they care to. It doesn't reimburse some facility for taking care of them. It gives them more control, which is one of the reasons that people like
it. So there is flexibility then. That's a good thing. Right?
And it's not just for elders. It could be for people with disabilities and chronic conditions of all kinds.
Once you have started paying into it after 5 years, it doesn't matter if you are 30 or 70, you get the benefit.
Ilse Erner, would that be something that would represent help for you, and would it change your situation at all?
Yes, it would. I think it would definitely be helpful, because when you're trying to put together a care package for an elderly parent, you quickly discover that there is virtually nothing there. That the options are you can live independently, or you could privately pay for a caretaker, which is prohibitive, or you go into a nursing home, which is not covered by any social insurance programs that we have available.
All right, Todd Zwillick, give us the bad news. What are the politics of this? And let's note that the nursing home lobby, the nursing home industry, is one of the biggest contributors to political campaigns in the United States, I believe.
Yeah, that's true. They're gigantic, actually. There's nursing homes in almost every community in the country. Let's add real quickly that Medicaid does pay for nursing home care. Mm-hmm. Medicare does not. But what Medicaid is great, that's good that it pays, but that means that a lot of people who don't qualify for Medicaid, they have to spend all their assets to become poor so they can get nursing home care. John, you asked real quick what the problem is. The problem is cost. Under the Class Act, people who want to be in, who opt in, they start paying premiums in 2011. But the program doesn't start paying benefits until 2016. And the concern over this is for the deficit, that once that five-year window of collecting all the money but not paying all the money passes, it's just going to explode the deficit because our population is aging, right? So after 2016, it won't be able to cover the bills, but the taxpayers will have to cover the bills, just like with Medicare and Social Security, and it'll explode the deficit. So there have been some moderate and conservative Democrats who say, we want it out. We want it out of the bill.
Paula Spann, this debate in Congress really represents something of a recognition of a real cultural shift that's taken place. The extended family doesn't really exist in America for broad groups of the population. And the way that elders were cared for in previous generations, that infrastructure doesn't exist anymore. Do you think that we're capable of picking up the slack with a federal program and beginning these conversations?
I'd actually disagree there, John. Families are still the backbone of long-term care. Most people are not in any kind of facility. They're not getting any kind of help. Their families are doing it. So it is true that we no longer tend to move our parents in with us, as Ilza has done, but it is not true that we've abandoned our elderly citizens or our younger disabled people. We're still on the hook for this.
It's not so much abandoned. It's that families are more scattered, and the cost of actually bringing people together is higher than it would have been if everyone lived in the same town, you know, as two or three generations ago.
I think the bigger issue is that people live so much longer.
Of course.
Things that used to be fatal are now chronic manageable conditions, and so this additional lifespan is not necessarily healthy, and so people have to step up and fill the gap.
All right. Paula Spann is the author of When the Time Comes, Families with Aging Parents Share Their Struggles and Solutions, and you can hear more from her on the New York Times blog, The New Old Age. Ilza Erner, how old is your mom again?
She's 90.
Wow. And she's doing great, right?
She's doing okay. She cannot live alone. She has to be watched over. She's at risk for falling. And, you know, she needs some basic kind of caregiving in terms of having her house cleaned and her meals cooked and her errands run. But by and large, she's doing okay. Yeah.
All right. Ilza Erner, thanks so much for allowing us to come into your family there for just a moment. She's a professor at Hunter College School of Social Work, lives in upstate New York, and is the caregiver for her mother, and her father is in a nursing home. Todd Zwillick, a last thought quickly.
Well, this is going to be a big fight. The Dems, we've talked all week, John, about how many problems there are with this bill. This class act may come out before this debate is over. It's one of a long list of problems.
Well, for an important discussion, hopefully it won't be moot politically. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks for that. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's take a look at some of the stories we're following with Miles O'Brien filling in for Celeste Headlee.
Thank you, John. A defect that can cause a child to be trapped has resulted in the largest crib recall in U.S. history. More than 2 million drop-side cribs by Stork Craft Manufacturing are being recalled after reports of four kids being suffocated. Inez Tenenbaum, chairman of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, spoke about the crib defect on NBC this morning.
Short of replacing the crib, if you can get the kit from Storkcraft to make the side immovable, that's another remedy.
Officials say owners shouldn't use the cribs until they get that repair kit from the manufacturer. Once again, that's Storkcraft. President Barack Obama is nearly ready to announce the new U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says the president held a rigorous final meeting with his Afghanistan War Council yesterday. He's expected to give a primetime news conference a week from today.
In international news, China says it has executed two people for their role in a tainted milk powder scandal in which at least six children died and more than 300,000 became sick. Coming up, the New York Times' Louise Story joins us to take a pulse of the economy. The latest gross domestic product and Case-Shiller numbers are out. We'll talk more in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Quick takeouts now on stories we want you to stay on top of. Miles O'Brien is with me here, sitting in for Celeste Headlee. Miles, the gross domestic product is out. The recession is supposedly over. Joining us to talk about what the GDP growth means is Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. Louise, within the hour, we got this number. GDP growth in the last quarter, 2.8%.
Yep. You remember a month ago, it was first estimated that it would be up 3.5%. And on the show, we were playing, you know, celebrate party music. And what we're seeing with these final figures is it's up, but not as much as we thought.
And did they revise the second quarter figure?
The whole picture is looking murkier than we thought. The recovery is not happening as fast as we thought.
And more argument to this sort of jobless recovery idea.
That's right.
The Case-Shiller home price index of 20 major cities was released today. What did that show?
So that showed a slight increase in the index of 20 cities. They're up again for the fifth straight month. Also released was Case-Shiller's national index, which only comes out four times a year. That was released for the third quarter, and that's up 3.1% over the prior quarter. So, you know, according to that index, we're seeing a recovery. But you know, when you break it down into pieces like existing home sales versus new home sales, you know, we see signs pointing in different directions. And part of this is just the uncertainty of where we're heading, whether that we're going to have a jobless recovery, and whether we're going to see more foreclosures. It's a bit tenuous.
Well, so is it a time to buy, Louise, if you're in the market?
Well, certainly they're low in a lot of places, but you know, some cities are still dropping. I mean, Las Vegas is still dropping. I mean, I don't think I would go buy in Las Vegas. They may have a while to go down. The places that had the biggest bubbles, in some cases, are still dropping.
And Louise, how do you sort out what's keeping this afloat? Some say it's simply the federal tax credit that's keeping this afloat. That we're riding on fumes. There's no structural change here.
We've got a good parallel, John. So it's the tax credit keeping the housing market afloat. I mean, the housing market benefits from that. Also, in the GDP figure, you know, it's widely accepted that the Cash for Clunkers program really helped that. Hmm. So in both instances, we are seeing a bit of a bubble there pushed forward by government incentives. And when the government pulls out, I'm not sure what will happen.
Training wheels on the economy. Louise Story, right. Finance reporter for our partners, The New York Times. Thanks so much. And now, Ibrahim Abdelmateen, our takeaway sports contributor. So there was a game last night. I missed it. Ibrahim, what happened?
Well, the Tennessee Titans beat the Houston Texans. It was almost at the very end of the game. The Texans almost tied it at their home stadium. The Tennessee Titans were the former Houston Oilers.
That's right.
And Vince Young, the quarterback of the Titans, was the all everything high school quarterback when he played in Houston. So there was a lot of storylines going into the game.
Yeah. And you know, the Titans started so bad, but they've been doing really, really well in the last four games.
It's true. Our producer here, David Fazekas, all season long, they were 0-6. They had a great season last year, and all season long he was like, put Vince Young in. Well, they put him in, and now they've won four straight.
It's like a reverse Giants.
Indeed, that's a good point.
But the Titans defeated the Texans 20-17. I guess it was a field goal at the end, right?
Correct. Yep.
And what does this say about the Texans? Do they have a playoff picture?
They are still in it, but it's very shaky and murky, and they're probably not going to get in it. But they have one of the best passing attacks in the league.
And we should disclose that you're totally biased here.
Well, this is interesting. There's a guy named Andre Davis who's a kick returner for the right. Texans. His older brother used to run track with me, and he's younger than us, and we used to pick on him and make fun of him and joke with him because he was the scrawny guy. Then next thing I know, I see him. The next thing I see him from when he was a kid, he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated with his arms outstretched.
Not so scrawny.
Not at all. It makes like $8 million a year or something like that.
Yeah. So you're on the sideline for these games, right?
Well, I'm like, wow, I wish I could be there.
Ibrahim Abdelmateen, takeaway sports contributor. And, you know, stay with us, Ibrahim, because actually our last takeout comes from listeners. A whole bunch of reactions to things we were talking about yesterday, including this reaction is directly for you, Ibrahim.
This is Karen calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. The Major League Soccer Championship game was played Sunday night to a sellout crowd in Seattle. Just so you know, Real Salt Lake beat the LA Galaxy with David Beckham in an exciting game that went into overtime and was finally resolved by penalty kicks and a final score of 5-4. Sadly, I didn't hear about it on the takeaway.
So what do you got for Karen, Ibrahim?
Okay, I'll take the NASCAR out of my mouth, and I apologize, Karen. Like many soccer fans who are fair-weather soccer fans, I've been looking more towards the World Cup play, and I missed what was right underneath my own nose, so that is a mistake, and we will correct that.
All right.
What about
all right,
cricket?
Karen?
Have you done cricket?
Hey, now you're going to get Karen calling us.
Come on.
Hey. All right, a bunch of folks were happy to share advice about subjects to avoid at the Thanksgiving table, like sports.
Hello, it's Dr. Atkins calling. Sports can cause quite some difficulty in a conversation. My brother-in-law is a devout Yankees fan, and I have been told that you cannot talk about the Mets in that house. Somewhat intolerant there.
Bonnie in Tacoma, Washington, born in the 40s, have a brother and a sister born in the late 30s.
When we had family get-togethers at my folks' house in Seattle, as I was growing up, my older sister would arrive late, leave early, and eat as much as she could and not talk with anybody much.
Sounds like my house a little bit.
Really? Nobody talks?
Yeah, we talk about stuffing and weather. Leave it at that. Religion, politics, sports, forget it. All right, we also talked yesterday, or actually you also talked yesterday, about the cost of health care and how it forces people to ration their own or face bankruptcy. Here's one story from Lee in Oklahoma City.
4 years ago, I had to go into the emergency room in Las Vegas to determine if I had a heart attack or not. I spent 12 hours in the hospital and had cardio tests that accumulated to $6,000 in bills. It has taken me 4 years of working a second job to pay that off because I had no insurance.
This is Judy from North Carolina. We are paying $1,127 for Blue Cross Blue Shield. We've just been notified it's going up to $1,359 per month. We are self-employed. We're a small corporation, but we're just the two of us in our jobs, and we don't know how we're going to carry on.
Voices, your voices on issues like health care. You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we launch into space. Not exactly the final frontier for the Obama administration, but we'll talk about how committed the new administration is to outer space. The head of NASA joins us in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee with John Hockenberry. Coming up, the head of NASA joins us to talk about how NASA can inspire kids to study engineering and science, make it cool. Here's some of the news stories we're following, 30 minutes past the hour. We may find out what the new strategy is in Afghanistan as early as next week. Reports say President Obama is expected to address the nation in prime time a week from tonight, lay it all out. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs explains why reaching this point has been so difficult.
There are a lot of different layers to our involvement in Afghanistan, how it relates to the region, what its impact is on our forces, what its impact is on our fiscal situation.
The president is welcoming the Indian Prime Minister to the White House as we speak. Afghanistan is one of the subjects on the agenda for today's talks. Earlier this week, the Indian Prime Minister said it would be a catastrophe for Asia if the Taliban returned to power. Officials in South Carolina are considering possible impeachment proceedings to remove Governor Mark Sanford from office. Sanford faces ethics charges over his summertime disappearance and his tearful revelation that he was in Argentina with a mistress.
Yes, this Thanksgiving, it's not over the river and through the woods. No, many grown sons and daughters, we learn, won't be traveling cross-country. They'll be coming to dinner from their old bedroom, down the hall and up the stairs. A study by the Pew Research Center counted nearly one in seven parents with grown children who had moved back home to ride out the recession in the past year. So Thanksgiving, maybe in a crowded house, but hopefully the kids will help with some of the chopping and food prep.
One would hope.
Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The astronauts on board the International Space Station, a dozen of them in all, have been up for hours already.
You're so past 70s, Mile.
I know. It's a retro kind of thing,
yeah,
you know? I'm feeling very Kubricky. In the past hour, they gave a press conference about the work they've been doing this past week. I wish it was a wheeled space station like it was in the movie. Anyway,
someday I'll get to it.
There was a journalist here on Earth. They're not up there. We both tried to do that. One journalist on Earth asked astronaut Leland Melvin what his favorite moment so far was.
Last night when we had dinner over at Node 1, we all kind of sat down and, you know, Frank pulled out some Belgian food and we had all different kinds of Russian food and we all sat down and kind of reflected on the mission. It's always the personal, interpersonal things when we come together that makes us a good team, a great team.
What, no space food sticks?
Belgian
no Tang?
Food. A first for NASA.
Belgian beer?
Belgian
beer. I don't know if they did that. Probably not. The Atlantis will begin its voyage to Earth tomorrow. They're going to close the hatch a little bit later today. Now, if I were at that press conference, I would have asked them how they think NASA can help stem the tide on the STEM problem.
I'm not following you here.
STEM. It's an acronym. It's NASA.
Oh.
Science, technology, engineering, and math.
Oh, I gotcha.
American 15-year-olds now rank 21st in science, 25th in math compared to their peers around the world. That's not good. We shouldn't let that occur. We're joined now by the NASA administrator, Charlie Bolden, a former astronaut, marine fighter pilot, the son of two educators. Full disclosure here, I'm on the NASA Advisory Council heading the Committee on Education and Public Outreach. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning, Miles. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. What can NASA do to inspire and engage kids and get them excited about science? As the president said, let's make science cool again.
Well, our primary intent is to expose them to the opportunities that are available in math and science and engineering, help them understand exactly what engineering means. You know, what is it? Because we throw the term around, but there are a lot of teachers who don't even know what it means to be an engineer. So we have lots of assets in the way of astronauts and spaceships and 10 centers around the country that we, starting this summer, are hoping to use to expose as many kids as possible to the opportunities available in these fields.
Yeah, some of this is beyond NASA's purview because some of it is the way it is taught in classrooms. But NASA is a great reminder to them that engineering can lead you to great goals.
That's correct. And, you know, just by being in communities the way that we are attempting to be, by allowing astronauts to go into schools where they would not otherwise see someone who has attained that particular height in life, that opens new doors to kids that never imagined they could do that before.
All right. Well,
Charlie, I mean, with all the budgetary restrictions at NASA and the frustrations over the last 10 to 15 years, is NASA a great place for an engineer to have a career these days?
NASA is a fantastic place for engineers to have a place to work. In fact, I think in the latest poll of best places to work in the country, NASA is either number one or number two as a general rule, unless you're working in Washington. But the NASA centers are great places to work. We have tremendous programs for college interns and co-ops. And, in fact, the secretary for the present crew, STS-129, I was listening to her do an interview yesterday. She came to the NASA family as a high school co-op and found that it was something that would allow her to contribute to the space program. And she's just as important as an astronaut on the shuttle.
All right. Well, help us out. You know, John and I are here. We grew up in the generation, and you were there, too, where we watched the space race unfold. You know, the sister Grace Edwards would roll the TV in, and we watched the launches. We were all engaged because it was so much a part of our lives. How do we recreate that?
Well, you know, Miles, as you and I have talked in the past, we need to get out on the street. We need to pound the pavement and help kids understand, not just kids, help kids and their parents understand what we're trying to do now. We're involved in an incredible, and I won't call it a race, but we're involved in an incredible contest for technological leadership in the world. And the only way we can maintain that leadership is by continuing to do the types of engineering development and innovation that NASA and the nation have always been known for.
Charles.
That's what we intend to do.
Charles, I need to disclose something. Miles disclosed that he's on the commission, right?
Yeah, NASA Advisory Council.
I was one of the journalist in space candidates. Any chance I could redeem that for a ride?
Well, you never know, John. You know, we only have a few flights left in 2010, but there will be other vehicles. So that the message for people is that going into space does not end when the shuttle is phased out. We're hoping to develop another vehicle. We're going to be dependent on the Russians and other international partners for a while. But NASA engineers right now are busily working to try to develop a follow-on for shuttle.
All right, well, let's talk about that for just a minute, because we're talking about a 5, maybe 7-year gap there when the shuttle retires, probably 2011 now, to whenever this next vehicle comes along. That's it. What do you do to keep kids engaged, keep them excited about being a part of this whole science and engineering campaign during that period?
Well, Miles, we'll still have astronauts who are venturing into space and will be there 365 days a year, American astronauts. It will be not unlike the period of time between 1975 when we flew the last Apollo mission and Apollo Soyuz and 1981 when we launched shuttle. During that period of time, we had no flights. We had no Americans going into space. Our Soviet back then counterparts were. So we're going to go through a period of time where we don't have an American organic capability to get to space, but we have scheduled seats on Soyuz where we're going to have American astronauts going into space 365 days over the next 5 years.
All right.
So
marching,
kids can do that.
Charlie, marching forward, what is NASA's mission? Is it to go to a planet or is it to inspire kids and have them take up these professions of engineering and mathematics and science?
my number one goal, Miles, I learned something, and that is you can't inspire someone if they haven't been exposed to it. So, again, as you've heard us talk about on the NASA Advisory Council, we want to find ways to get NASA engineers, NASA astronauts out into schools, into communities, so that we can let kids know that there are opportunities there. Once we do that, then we can inspire them. But we've got to expose them to what's available. We've got to expose them to airplanes and to drones or unmanned aerial vehicles, rockets, things like that. So that's our goal over the coming years.
Charlie Bolden, NASA Administrator, thanks for your time this morning. Coming up, we continue our week-long series on faith. Today, how does a relationship work when there are two differing faiths involved? And how do you navigate those waters during the holiday season? More on that later this hour. And this is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckabee. As President Obama nears his final decision about how many more U.S. soldiers to send to Afghanistan, there are delays in parliamentary elections in Iraq, and it could slow American troop withdrawals from that country. The resurgence of tribal and ethnic tensions that have previously boiled over into a low-level civil war are partly at fault for these election delays, but there have been delays politically on all kinds of issues in Iraq. Joining us now is Stephen Lee Myers, New York Times reporter in Baghdad. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Now, the delay of the elections and this connection to a slowing of the pace of U.S. troop withdrawals, how connected are they?
I think that all along the Obama administration and the commander here, General Odierno, had planned their withdrawal around this major event, the national election, which originally was supposed to be in December. It was then pushed back into January. I think the idea from the American side was they wanted to keep a robust American presence on the ground, even if they weren't actively involved in security, as they haven't been since last summer. They're in a position to help with intelligence and just be a backup, a rapid reaction force in case things go wrong with the election. Now that the election seems to be delayed even farther, it's going to complicate that plan.
With 120,000 U.S. troops currently in Iraq, what are the thresholds for triggering a withdrawal? Is it just sort of a general assessment of security, or is it very specific declarations of Iraq being able to take care of its oil, being able to demonstrate a political independence from the U.S. military presence?
Well, I think all along the administration, President Obama's plan has been to begin the withdrawal of under his plan, there are only supposed to be 35,000 to 50,000 American forces left by next August, and I think that that withdrawal, for a lot of reasons, is going to continue. The question is, when can you begin it? And General Odierno, looking around at the security situation, the political situation, decided to keep as many as possible until after the election, that now with the election being delayed, it's going to be much harder to keep as many here. I don't think the administration has specifically tied the withdrawals to progress on political issues, economic issues, and so forth. But clearly, they would like to see Iraq make more progress on that so that there was more comfort that as the Americans withdrew, Iraq would remain a stable place.
Finally, Stephen Lee Myers, is it possible that Odierno would be forced to increase the withdrawal in, say, Kurdistan or in the south, that there would be an asymmetric withdrawal and that certain territories, because of the better security situation, would benefit from that?
I believe that they have a plan to withdraw gradually across the country. Already there are fewer American troops, for example, in the south where things are much quieter, as well as in Kurdistan in the north. The Americans will remain, even after the August deadline, in bases around Baghdad and the other major cities. They will remain in an advisory role, less than a combat or security role. So I don't think that there's going to be much change in the drawdown over the next year.
All right. Thanks for that update. Stephen Lee Myers, New York Times reporter in Baghdad, reporting on delays in parliamentary elections in Iraq that might slow American troop withdrawals from that country.
It's Good morning. I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlie here with John Hockenberry.
You've got 10 more minutes. You could still mess it up, Miles. You've done pretty well so far.
Coming around the clubhouse turn. Yeah, so far, no huge transgressions.
Looking pretty good.
I did say Headlie, but I did Headlie just now. So forgive me, Celeste.
Yikes.
Forgive me, Celeste. I'm sitting in your seat. I'll get the name right. Coming up, we're going to talk about interfaith relationships, how to make them work during the holidays. Our week-long series on faith continues in a few moments. But first, we'll check the headlines about 48 minutes past the hour. It is the largest crib safety recall in U.S. history. More than 2 million drop-side cribs by Stork Craft Manufacturing of Canada being recalled after reports of four infant suffocations. Robert Sirigliano is the father of a baby who died in one of those drop-side cribs.
The thing was, there was never any warnings about these cribs. And after research, we found that a lot of these cribs had caused injuries and deaths.
Officials say owners shouldn't use the cribs until they get a repair kit from the manufacturer, Stork Craft.
President Obama is meeting right now with the Indian Prime Minister at the White House. Prime Minister Mohammed Singh spoke with the president just a few moments ago. And on the agenda for discussions between the Indian Prime Minister and the president is the situation in Afghanistan, which we learned this morning. The president will announce his new strategy as early as a week from tonight. Joining us now to talk more about the speech that the president is expected to give to announce that U.S. strategy in Afghanistan is Eric Schmidt from our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
So how much of this speech is going to be a sell job on the strategy, and how much of it is simply going to be a notification of some significant details changing?
Well, I think it's going to be both. Obviously, the president is going to be laying out his strategy review that he's now been considering for several weeks. He had held his ninth and what we believe to be his final meeting with his NSC advisors last night for 2 hours at the White House. But he's got a big selling case to make to the American public and to the Congress, including members of his own party who are increasingly concerned about the troop commitment, the costs, and the reliability of partners in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
You know, Eric, in the back and forth on this, and we've talked about meeting a couple of weeks ago where four options were presented and the team was sent back to the drawing board. How much do you think this speech will hint? And again, I don't want to put you in speculative zone here, but how much of this speech might hint at the end game, an assurance of some sort of end game in Afghanistan?
I think that's going to be a major part of the speech, although the president has to be careful. He wants to reassure the American public that this is an open-end commitment, but he has to remember that he has important allies in Afghanistan and Pakistan who are already concerned about his resolve and commitment to the region. So he's walking a fine line between not wanting to have American troops there forever, but also signaling to the to not only the Pakistanis and the Afghans, but to European allies, that the United States is committed to get the job done.
And the president is meeting with the Indian Prime Minister even today. Eric Schmidt from our partner, The New York Times, talking about the announcement from the White House. Apparently, there will be a primetime speech next week to reveal the Obama strategy in Afghanistan. Eric, thanks so much.
One nation under God, indivisible.
Specific divine being.
Religious discrimination.
Rediscovering God in America.
I truly do believe it's a miracle.
One nation under God.
Power of faith.
All this week, we're talking about faith in America, about politics, about religion, about faith without religion. In short, all the things you're not supposed to talk about in good company, right?
Today, or Thanksgiving dinner.
It could be really ugly. Talk about a food fight. Today, as we get ready to gather for that dinner, many of us are girding for some of those awkward moments when the conversation turns to religion. And there are more than one religious traditions gathered around the turkey. It gets complicated. More than a quarter of Americans who are living with or married to their partner are in an interfaith relationship. This comes from the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life.
Which can also make things more adventurous.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it built in diversity in the household.
Yes, indeed.
Good for the kids. So, but how do you navigate all the treacherous shoals? It gets difficult when you get the parents involved, right? Especially over the holidays. To help us mull over these issues, Laurel Snyder, editor of the essay collection Half-Life, Jewish Tales from Mixed Faith Homes. Also joining us right here are Christy Neller-Hempel and Ravi Hempel, who recently got married. They're expecting. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Christy comes from a Baptist background. Ravi is Hindu, and they live in Brooklyn now. Let's start with you, Laurel. Good morning to you, by the way.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. You were raised in a Jewish Catholic home, right?
That's right. My dad is Jewish. My mom's Catholic.
Okay, so there's plenty of guilt served up at Thanksgiving
sure.
dinner there for sure on that one. But explain how did you handle all of that, and was it confusing?
Well, the short version is that my family made a really conscious choice when I was young to raise me Jewish. That was sort of a deal brokered when I was, before I can remember. And so I always had a clear sense of identity when somebody said, like, what religion are you in right. third grade or something? I knew that I was Jewish. There was a sort of second comment that I then had to add, which, you know, I might or might not, which was, well, and my mom's Catholic. But I always had a very clear understanding of those delineations. And so, like, you know, sort of mom had a Christmas tree, and we all had mom's Christmas tree. But there was never any real confusion over the theology of it for me,
right.
Which isn't the case in every home.
It could be confusing, though. And I'm curious, you decided to marry a Catholic. And was that something you sought out, or is it just like, you know, this worked for you and as you grew up?
It's not that simple. I think I ran away for a while and tried to go. And I mean, this is definitely something that I struggled with. I mean, thinking about marriage in the theoretical, but I think that thing happens where you meet somebody and they're the right person and you want to spend your life with them, and suddenly the list of things you had, you know, that you wanted in a partner fly out the window because this is the right person inside.
All right, let's turn to Ravi now and Christy, who are here and expecting in May. And I'm curious, when you announced that you were getting married, let's start with you, Christy. What was the reaction, the family reaction? Any issues?
Not really. Everyone was pretty excited. Again, my family had met Ravi for several years before that, so fell in love with him as a person. So I think there probably might have been reservations, you know, just from a faith standpoint, but none really expressed to me.
But when you're growing up in the Baptist church, it's not like you want to grow up and marry a nice Hindu, right?
Right.
That's not necessarily one of your dreams.
Well, not only that, but just not really exposed to Hinduism or really that much diversity at all, you know? So, it was a learning curve, I think, for my family.
Now, for Ravi, who grew up as a Hindu in Canada.
That's right.
How did it go when you presented this whole idea to your family?
You know, it wasn't as shocking as I thought it would be. You know, at first, I think my mother really thought that I was always going to marry this Indian, you know, Hindu girl, and that would be the way it was. But my dad
and
was
a specific Hindu girl, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. It's like one that they picked, and so
not good.
No, not good. And it was very different. But my dad, you know, coming over in 1964, you know, was discriminated against quite a bit, and so I think his goal was always to make us feel like we were going to have a normal childhood and sort of have this idea of sort of assimilating us in the culture pretty easily. So
he embraced this idea.
He embraced it. He really embraced it.
And embraced Christy, literally.
He did. You know, one of the first things he said was that, oh, you know, that Baptists are very similar to Hindus.
Really?
I never got the explanation why, but he fell right into it.
I'll leave you
I can
all
hear
to
Laurel
connect,
is laughing
connect
on the line there.
Laurel, you know, one of the things you talk about in your essays is that your husband is kind of an apathetic Catholic. The legions of apathetic Catholics are out there. Does that, in a way, help if one person or even both are not too fervent about their religion?
There's certainly a lot of ways of approaching this. I think it's a lot simpler when there's a dominant religion in the household. I think that there, and it depends on what the mix is. Obviously, you know, like a Buddhist universalist blend would be easier than, say, a Catholic, like a strong Catholic Orthodox Jewish blend, like religiously. But I think that it certainly, in my case, was kind of a deal breaker. If my husband had said, no, it's really important that we raise our children in the body of Christ, as a Jewish woman, I couldn't.
Ravi and Christy, do you have a dominant religion in the household?
I wouldn't say so.
Yeah. But
no.
We got to ask the question, though.
Yeah.
We got to ask the question. When's the baby due?
May 3rd.
And you're going to raise the baby?
Well, I think we want to have it be pretty open. We want them exposed to both religions and, you know, feed as much information as possible and sort of, you know, as they grow older, let them choose. That's sort of our general
Robbie,
take on it right
you,
now.
You down with that? Totally down with that,
Rob? Sort of sheepish. I wish people could see that look right now.
No, I mean, I think they need to be exposed to both. And I think that's the thing where I think my parents are going to come into play a little bit in terms of, like, teaching them a little bit.
But, yeah.
I mean, the thing is, I went to Sunday school when I was younger, which doesn't make any sense.
Oh, it's a great story. Well, good luck and happy Thanksgiving to all of you. They're great.
Yes. Laurel Snyder was on the phone, and Christy Neller-Hampole and Ravi Hampole, we wish them well. I enjoyed meeting them.
Yes, indeed. It's part of our faith series, which continues tomorrow on the first day of the Hajj. We're going to talk to the special representative to Muslim communities, Farah Pandit, and she's going to talk about what it means to be a Muslim living in America and to explain why we need a special representative in the U.S. State Department. That's tomorrow.
I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee. Thanks for driving the bus for me this morning.
Sure. Well, you're driving, too. I'm John Hockenberry. Yeah. This is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.